and it's Monday, November 22nd, 2010, Ethics, and we're finishing up Aristotle and moving on to Friedrich Nietzsche. Anyone have any questions on Aristotle from last time? We just left off talking about the Aristotelian virtues. I am an explorer. I. I think last time we were talking about the various virtues. Remember, virtue is a meaning between extremes. It's between the extremes of excess and deficiency. So having virtue means doing the right amount of something at the right time. So if you take fighting, you have the virtue of courage. On either side, you have the extreme of cowardice and berserkerhood or something, foolhardiness. And then the mean is someplace between there, more towards the fighting side. How do you know where exactly it is between fighting and running away? Well, you have to use your judgment. And Aristotle says you can't come up with a formula, you can't come up with a book that will tell you exactly when to fight and when to run away. You need to learn that through experience. Maybe an analogy is learning to use a stick shift. You can read the manual, you can have somebody tell you about it until you've actually tried it. It's tough to learn how to drive a stick shift. It's a skill. And Aristotle thinks about morality as being a skill. Some other virtues: honesty, the right amount of truth telling, and moderation is a classical one. Moderation meaning moderation in eating and drinking. These virtues, it's important to remember too, they're good for you and they're good for society. But it's not as if there's this distinction between the right thing to do and what's in your interest. It's thought that virtue is what allows you to be a successful human being. And it's also virtues widespread in the community allow the community to be successful. And there isn't this conflict between what's good for you and what's good for society. And it's thought generally that if you have virtue, you're going to be a happy, successful, prosperous person, barring some piece of bad luck. And your community is going to be successful. And I think Aristotle would say to somebody like Glaucon that, look at your criminals, look at your people who are of low moral character, and those are people that aren't very happy, they're not very successful, and they're not as successful as if they had had virtue. So there might be someone who succeeded in spite of being not being virtuous. So think of someone, for example. What's that?
Chairman Mao,
yeah. He kind of sort of... Chairman Mao, maybe he had kind of persistence and maybe some skill at organizing people. And you might think, well, he seemed to be pretty successful, but maybe he would have been even more successful if he had not been evil. if he hadn't been a person of low moral character, maybe he would be celebrated today as the world's greatest political leader, instead of only being celebrated by some people who don't know history or have a strange value scheme. I was thinking about someone, sometimes you'll have a person who's very talented, and so they can get by on their talent, and they can be an awful human being. Look at Britney Spears, right? So there's a person who has wonderful singing talent, and is good at dancing and good at entertaining, right? You might not care for her voice. Maybe you think she sounds like one of the Munchkins from The Wizard of Oz. But a lot of people like her singing. And mechanically, artistically, she seems to have a good singing voice. and she's good at entertaining. But her personal life is a nightmare, right? She's got more money than God, and why is she driving her own SUV, you know, when she's under the influence with the carrying the baby in front of the, I mean, she shows up in the tabloids, and you look at her, and she's cutting off her hair, and just like, she has all manner of psychological problems, trouble with the law, right? Lindsay Lohan, you can think of all your entertainers and your people, I'm trying to think of someone who's been in the news lately. Go back to Michael Jackson, right? So you have people with drug addiction, with behavior problems. And so Aristotle would say that those people have it made. They have wealth, they have fame, they have all the good things in life, but because they don't have virtue, they end up killing themselves, they end up with health problems, because they're addicted to drugs, they have relationship problems because they're of a bad moral character. And that those people would even be better off if they had virtue. So while virtue isn't necessary to have a successful life, sometimes you can get lucky, or sometimes you can be in the right place at the right time. It helps a lot. And once you get some of the other rewards in life, the good things in life, it helps you manage them. And so if you end up like, you know, Elvis Presley and Marilyn Monroe, and you end up being very successful from a materialistic point of view, and from a fame and acclaim point of view, and maybe in your career and so on, virtue keeps you from killing yourself, or and it helps you manage those things.
There's no.
Thank you. Stop right here.
Just a second here.
So a couple advantages of virtue ethics. One is that ethics is empirically justified. And so how do you know what things are virtues and which things are vices? Well, you look at who are the successful people. What are they doing? What sorts of things tend to make people successful in their lives? What sorts of things seem to make them unsuccessful? And so you look at people who are miserable, people who commit suicide, people who end up in jail, people who end up coming to a bad end. What do they do? And Aristotle would say, well, on the extreme end, you know, they're the murderers and thieves and the robbers. On maybe a less extreme side, they're the drunks, they're the gluttons who ruin their health, they're the people that maybe don't eat enough and ruin their health that way. There are the people, the liars, the gossips that nobody wants to talk to, the people with no social graces. And then you can look at other people with problems with integrity, or the cowards. So he sort of goes through the line, goes down the line and thinks about those, you know, how the way you behave on a daily basis can lead you to be successful or unsuccessful. And virtue are those characteristics which will allow you to be successful with a little bit of luck during it. And again, Aristotle is a realist, so he recognizes that you could do all the right things and just be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And something bad could happen to you. Like, Chandra Levy, they just had the trial of, I don't know if anybody's following that. This woman, she was an intern for a congressman, Gary Condon, from Modesto, and she turned up dead. And it looked like maybe he had her bumped off because they were having an affair. And it turns out they were having an affair, but he wasn't the guy that killed her. It was some psycho who attacked her when she was jogging through a park. And so you might say that even if Chandra Levy didn't have an affair with this congressman, which was Aristotle would say would be an occurrence of vice, still that would have made a difference as to whether or not she was raped and killed in a public park, right? Just jogging through the thing. She was in the wrong place at the wrong time. maybe she wasn't prudent, I suppose you might say, of being by herself in the middle of this area. But you know, you can go through a safe area. You can be just walking home one day from class, and a big thunderstorm comes up all of a sudden, and you're just walking by a tree, and the lightning comes down and hits the tree near you, and you get a little jolt, and you're electrocuted, and that's the end of you. Did you do anything to deserve it or to cause that? No, it just happened. So you know, sometimes things just happen, and Aristotle recognizes that. there's no egoism, altruism dichotomy. So again, there's no tug of war between what's good for me and what's good for society. Aristotle says those are the same. And this way, he's very close to Ayn Rand. So you can think about, I remember Rand says that the answer to Glaucon is that being a criminal is almost never in your interest. And even if it's in your interest at a particular moment in time, people are creatures of habit, and a person who steals once is going to be tempted to steal again. And so it's important to have to do the right thing consistently, because even though there might be some occasions where it might be to your advantage to do something underhanded, in the long run, it's better to have a virtuous character. What's good for you is good for others. And another thing that a lot of people like about Aristotle is he does understand that you can't have a formula for morality. That to learn to be a good person is something that takes time to learn. And people with experience gain wisdom in knowing how to deal with moral dilemmas and so on. And it's not something that can be taught in a formula or a book or quantified. Morality is a skill. Yeah.
Well, if it is a skill, then couldn't you have like a very wise teacher, you know, of teaching you to be moral, essentially?
Actually, I think Aristotle would agree with that. He likes the idea of role models and thinks that one of the best ways to learn morality is by, you know, seeing what successful people do. I think he would still say, though, that it's one thing to observe someone else and to get advice from someone, but it's different, like, to actually do it. So if you think about some skill, like, it really helps, actually, once you get past a certain place, like if you try to learn how to shoot an arrow. And so, like, if you're, like, with a master archer, and he says, okay, keep your back straight, you know, pull back a little more, okay, you got to hold your hand steady, maybe do some exercise to work those arms to make sure you can hold the bow taut for a long period of time. Now, where's the wind coming from, right? And the person says, I don't feel any wind. And he's like, wait a minute. And it's like, okay, there's a breeze coming. How fast is it going? You know, I don't know. It's like, that's 4.3 miles an hour, or whatever, right? So you need to make an adjustment of, you know, so much, and the person would tell you everything they did. And that is only going to be so useful to you until you shoot a bunch of arrows and try to do what they tell you and reproduce it. So I think he would say that having an expert in morality helps. And actually, I think he's different in... he's different from Plato in that Plato says there are no experts in morality. Whereas Aristotle thinks there really are. It's people that have a lot of experience can actually give better moral advice than a young person with no experience. And so, interestingly, a corollary or a result of Aristotle's theory is that older people will be wiser, all of the things being equal. I mean, if they're of a good character, and they'll be in some ways better than younger people. They'll be wiser and have better judgment. And, I don't know, you can make your judgment as some of you younger students that it's easy to find people who are older who have no judgment whatsoever, but you can think, well, you know, all other things being equal, do older people who do have a good moral character, do they tend to have better moral judgment than people who are young, rash, and foolish? I'll leave that up to you. Criticisms, underlying the underlying teleology. Teleology is this notion of a goal-centered theory or a purpose-centered theory. And so the question is, do natural things have a purpose or function? Does man have a function? Does a frog have a purpose? Is a frog's purpose to eat flies? Is a fish's purpose to swim and eat krill or whatever it eats? I guess this is a whale. Fish tend to eat other fish, or they eat little tiny sea creatures, or sometimes plants. But you think about the natural things having a purpose seems to assume some sort of divine mind or a grand architect of the universe or a designer. And so, absent a designer, if you're an atheist, does it make sense to say the purpose of the purpose of the sun is to warm the earth, or the purpose of now, I suppose you could say the purpose of your heart is to pump blood. So within the system, your body system, you have certain organs with certain functions within the system. But then, so you could say, in the human being, the heart pumps blood, the kidneys filter the blood, the lungs bring in oxygen to the system, and so on. But does it make sense to say, but here's what a human being is for? Like, it makes sense to say, here's what a heart is for. But if you take, like, an entire biological organism and say, does it make sense to say, here's what human beings are for, what they're meant to do, without some sort of a God? I don't know, any thoughts on that? Yeah.
Couldn't you just say we're meant to procreate? I mean, if you look at our biological evolution, that's what we're meant to do. We're meant to procreate.
Well, I can procreate, but what's the difference between that and meant to? Like, I have the ability to do it. I have the design to do it. But what more does it mean that I says I'm meant to do it? Does that mean that if I don't do it, I'm doing something wrong? Like, if I don't have children, am I doing something unnatural? And is it wrong to do something unnatural? I mean, you might say sex is natural. Does that? But so is, biffing somebody in the face when they call you a name, right? But sometimes people will say, well, that might be a natural reaction. Is that necessarily moral?
I think if you think about it in the strictest terms, I think it makes total sense. Like you say, the heart is to pump blood. That's because over evolution, this is what it does best.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get to man, you start thinking about their design in the grander scheme. It doesn't need to be there. They just exist like any other organism. There mm-hmm. doesn't have to be a purpose. They're just doing the best they can at existing. It doesn't have to be about their morals or their anything. It just simply exists.
This notion of, like, doing what you're meant to do, or fulfilling your purpose, or doing what's natural, it makes sense. Like the hammer, right? Why does the hammer have a purpose? Well, yes, because someone designed the hammer for the specific purpose of pounding the nails. So I could understand God made man for a certain purpose. He designed them so they would act a certain way. But if you take the designer out of the equation, does it still make sense to say, here's what you were meant to do, here is the purpose of man, or here is the purpose of a frog? And now maybe things evolve that way, but it's hard for me to make sense of this idea of the purpose. I'm not sure if it can stand on its own. It's just that. And so some people have questioned whether this is really going to work with an artifact, with something that's designed by a mind. It makes sense to say this is what it's designed for. But if there's no designer, does it make sense to say this is what human beings were designed to do? And Aristotle says yes. Although Aristotle believes in a God, he doesn't think this is necessary to have a purpose. He thinks that it's self-evident, and you can observe a thing's purpose just by looking at what it does. And I'm not sure that purpose is something that can be observed. Just a thought. Yeah.
You say he believed in God, but he said that basically he was a religious person.
Yeah, Aristotle, for Aristotle, God's kind of an abstraction. He described God as thought thinking itself, or thinking. It literally in Greek, it's thinking. It's thought thinking about itself. So God is a being of pure thought. God is engaged in the activity of thinking. What is he thinking about? Well, he's thinking about his own nature, because that's the only thing fit for him to think about. So God is pure thought thinking about itself. And so he thinks that God is kind of the origin of the universe, and that he calls God the prime mover and the first cause of everything that exists. But God doesn't really, is sort of aloof and doesn't intervene in human events and doesn't have emotions and feelings. So for Aristotle, God's kind of a placeholder for the genesis of the universe, but he's not a conscious being that you can pray to and that does things in the world or has emotions or a personality. So it's more, I suppose, more like the kind of the Eastern concept of God as some kind of cosmic principle, which is responsible for the existence of the universe. Is there a virtue for every moral value? You know, can you find for any thing that you think is moral or immoral, can you find an appropriate virtue? You know, like, it's wrong to steal. So what is, like, where is the, you know, can you describe stealing as wrong as a mean between extremes? Is it too much stealing, not enough stealing? Or too much of respecting property rights and not enough of, you know, and does it mean like way over towards mostly respecting property rights, but if you can steal, if you won't give your friend his gun when he just found out his wife's been cheating on him and he's drunk, right? Is that, there's a case where you shouldn't respect property rights. But then is that really, that seems kind of like a kind of funny mean between extremes, right? It seems that stealing is wrong, but there's some exceptions. And to describe that as the right amount of respecting property rights or the right amount of giving people their due seems like to be a kind of artificial way of describing the fact that stealing is wrong or murder is wrong. It works really well for things like moderation and for courage, but for other things it doesn't seem that intuitive. And there's always the old classist argument that, you know, Aristotle's this aristocratic philosopher, and so what is the ideal life for man? The life of the aristocratic intellectual, with lots of servants and friends and money and so on and so forth. And also Aristotle does seem to want his theory to fit in with Greek culture, where there are certain social mores, and so Aristotle has a theory which conveniently seems to support you know, what Greek intellectuals thought were all the good things in life. Comments, questions, other criticisms? Yeah.
I think, okay, Aristotle's, it's kind of hard to I just have problems with successful people, the whole one of those things, because some successful people are complete dirtbags, only successful because they're really good at being, at devices. You do the devices, but so well, that's what leads to the success, like criminals. For example, and you can find multiple examples of people which, according to Aristotle theory, should be like the echelons of the virtue, but far from it. Let's say Pat Robinson. Mm-hmm. I mean, incredibly successful person. Millions of people, millions in 10 days, super rich, died at the age of like 90. But I don't think a lot of people would look at him like and go like, wow, that was an incredibly virtuous and awesome man. You know?
Yeah, some people might.
Well, you know, of course, we fan base, but I mean, yeah. I don't know.
I see what you mean. I think Aristotle might say that, like, part of being successful is not just, like, having everything you want, but it's being being rational, because remember he says that man is the rational animal. And so people, your goal is not just to like to get like materialistic things or to get fame, and so, although those things are, he thinks, will be produced by the virtuous life. But what you want to do is actualize your potential as a rational animal. And so I think Aristotle would say that if you're a person who builds their life on religion, that you're not actualizing your potential as a rational animal. You're being irrational. And so that might be kind of a hedge. And so that there's a case where he might say, though, that like Pat Robertson might have been actually, I mean, he had a degree in economics from some prestigious university. So like, he wasn't a dumb guy. He seemed to have a really good business model for his ministry. And so it might be that he's rational, like in a lot of other ways. Like, you know, he didn't turn out to be a hopeless drunk. He doesn't have a gambling problem like Bill Bennett. He's not having sex with a secretary like Jim Baker. He didn't end up in jail like Jim Baker. You know, so you can kind of go down the line where he, you know, didn't go overextended, and he didn't have to sell out his ministry like Jerry Falwell because he got into financial trouble. He's not taking pictures of prostitutes in a seedy hotel room like Jimmy Swaggart. So I mean, he did a lot of things right, and so to that degree, I mean, Aristotle would say he was a virtuous person in that he seemed to have taken good care of his family. He didn't have any personal addictions. He was a good businessman, and so on. So, I mean, there's some aspects. So it's not like an all-or-nothing proposition. But I think Aristotle would say that's marred by the fact that he's this kind of person who's spreading irrationality. You can pick your favorite irrational person, I guess. So it's like, and religion is a particular case in point where sometimes you can get people who are rational in a lot of other areas, but for some reason with religion they check their brain at the door and they have really kooky beliefs. And it's not just people who believe in certain fundamentalist versions of Christianity, but also like Scientology and some of the kind of out there theories that people have, and people that believe in magic and the occult, and so you get people that delve, they have all sorts of kind of irrational beliefs on the one hand, even though maybe in their day-to-day life they act in a rational way, meaning a prudent, goal-directed way, and they have maybe good street sense, but they have these sort of kooky beliefs on the side. Christianity, I think I mentioned last time, adopted Aristotle, its patron saint, and Thomas Aquinas, who is sort of the big cheese of medieval philosophy, the high mahimak, the top of the medieval philosopher, roster of Hall of Famers. Thomas Aquinas. His name's pretty much synonymous with medieval philosophy. And a lot of Aquinas is basically quoting Aristotle in the Bible. And he'll say, the philosopher has said, blah, 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 blah. And he goes, I want to give Aquinas credit because he is a systematic thinker. He does some good philosophy. He doesn't just quote Aristotle. He does a lot of his own philosophy. But he does rely heavily on Aristotle. His five arguments for God's existence come right out of Aristotle, for example. And he puts his sort of Christian spin on it. And he does the same thing with Aristotle's ethics. So Christianity kind of adopted Aristotle as their patron saint with some changes. So in the virtues, humility becomes a virtue and pride becomes a vice. So to take credit for your accomplishments and to revel in them, as Aristotle would say you should, is seen as bad, because you're taking the credit away from God. And so there's a passage like in the book of James, for example, and James says, you say to tomorrow we shall go to such and such a place and do business together. What you ought to say is, if the Lord is willing, then we'll go to such and such a place. And so this idea is that you always have to have in the back of your mind that God's the one who's allowing this to happen, that God's responsible, that God is owed thanks, and to God be the glory, and you should take credit for your accomplishments. And so to be a servant and to be a person who doesn't take credit is seen as a good thing. To labor in the spirit, to give with nobody knowing what you give, and so on. Poverty is seen as a virtue. Jesus says a lot of bad things about rich people, and this carries on through the Middle Ages. Wealth is seen as a snare and a trap. It takes your mind off of heaven and puts it on this earth. And Jesus essentially said it would be a miracle if a rich person ever got into heaven. Religious faith is again seen as a virtue. Intellectual activity is actually in some places seen as a bad thing. Paul says, don't be deceived by empty philosophy, vain deceit. And when he talks to the intellectuals on Mars Hill, after he's done speaking, they say, we'll hear you again on this, Paul. And they don't accept Jesus as their Savior. And so they're all going to hell. And I think the idea there is that they're too immersed into worldly philosophy, into reason, where faith is emphasized in medieval philosophy. Unconditional love, forgiving one's enemies, again, is seen as the height of virtue. Aristotle would say, love your friends, kill your enemies, or punish your enemies. And this idea that you ought to give unconditional love to everyone regardless of how they treat you, I think would have struck Aristotle as being somewhat bizarre. And maybe, irrational. Also, in Christianity, you get a tendency towards asceticism, which is denying bodily desires and wants for spiritual purpose. And so celibacy is given as an ideal by the Apostle Paul. And Paul thinks that the end of the world is coming soon. So he says, if you want to get married, it's better to marry than to burn with lust all the time. But he sees it as kind of a concession. He says he wished that everyone was celibate like he was. Jesus was celibate. Jesus said, blessed are those who become eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven. It's not clear whether he is being metaphorical or literal there. Nietzsche, who we'll get to in a moment, says, he quotes Jesus as saying, if your eye offends you, pluck it out, because it's better to go into heaven with one eye than to go into heaven with both. And Nietzsche says, not only an eye is meant here. And he's thinking about that passage where it says become a eunuch for the kingdom of heaven. And he describes Christianity as a religion of castrationism, where people, become soft and weak and deny their natural animal instincts. Courage becomes fighting temptation and fighting against the devil. So you do have, moderation is a great Christian virtue. Although there is this tendency that the mean between extremes is more towards the denial than towards the enjoyment. But you still might say moderation is a common Christian virtue. But this idea of courage, Jesus was essentially a pacifist. He said to turn the other cheek, pray for those that persecute you, and so on. So courage here is seen as a spiritual war against the devil, as opposed to literal fighting. Okay, now these changes to Aristotle and Christian morality in the Middle Ages are going to be important when we look at Nietzsche. Nietzsche says that these are all mistakes, and he wants to bring back people to more of a kind of Aristotelian view, where courage is really courage, where pride is brought back as a virtue. instead of like, you know, kicking the dirt and saying, oh, shucks, twerk nothing, man, right? You should say, you know, yeah, I did that, or, you know, look what I can do. You're supposed to brag about your accomplishments revel in them and take credit for them. And poverty is a bad thing, and you want to avoid it if you can. And Nietzsche has a lot of bad things to say about religious faith and turn the other cheek as well. As well as asceticism. So here's Nietzsche. That's one of my favorite pictures. He's got the signature mustache there, which it's kind of out of control. How do you eat soup like that? How do you eat anything like that? So anyway, that's Nietzsche. I think still a fairly young man, 1844 to 1900. There's dates. Nietzsche, one of the most difficult names to spell to philosophers. Freddie Nietzsche. Here's Nietzsche's young man. And here's one with, I think about the same period as that first picture. The piercing eyes. Every time you see a picture of him, he tends to have this sort of piercing stare about him. So Nietzsche's it's called a postmodern philosopher. We've talked about postmodern philosophy in here. But basically, let's see about Nietzsche. Nietzsche's coming out of the modern period where, with the rise of science, with the idea that everything in nature has a purpose, you have the rise of democratic capitalism, and just a lot of other things that are part of the modern period, the rediscovery of classical learning. And then after that, you have a lot of changes where you get this sort of a resurgence of relativism, secularism, and Nietzsche's is a part of that. So he had a background in classical Greek philosophy. He was a philologist, knew Greek philosophy, and actually, I think he got a lot of his ideas out of Plato, although he thinks that Plato was kind of a charlatan. And Nietzsche finds himself agreeing with people like Glaucon, and there's another fellow named Calicles, who gives this kind of conspiracy story, conspiracy theory of morality that Nietzsche latches onto later on. Nietzsche is also a fan of Aristotle, and he has a kind of a virtue ethics, and he's also got a teleology. So Nietzsche does have a teleological principle that he calls the will to power. And he also describes morality in terms of virtues. Although Nietzsche says, I'm going to tell you what makes a person virtuous, that all the things that you've heard make you virtuous actually are vices. And all the things that you've heard are vices are actually virtues. And this way, Nietzsche sort of turns morality on its head. And he kind of jokes about being the world's greatest immoralist. So at the time, if a person was a moral philosopher or a person who taught ethics, they were called a moralist or a moral philosopher. And so Nietzsche says, I'm not a moralist, I'm the world's greatest immoralist. Why? Because, not because he's preaching immorality, but because he thinks that people have things backwards, and that the things that people think are immoral are actually moral, and those things which are moral are that people think are moral are actually immoral. Is that right? God is dead. This statement, God is dead, you don't want to take it too literally. I saw somebody on the Facebook the other day was saying, the problem with saying that God is dead is it assumes that God existed in the first place. Facepalm. No, that's the point. Nietzsche's not saying that God, once upon a time there was a God, and he lived backwards for eternity until a certain point he got sick and died and was very sad, right? And he's actually not even talking about the literal existence of God. I mean, in Nietzsche's view, God never existed. But what he really means is that faith in God is dead. And this comes out in the parable of the madman, which I think is one of the most lyrical and poetic passages from Nietzsche. And I'll read a little bit of it here. Maybe you're taking an acting class, want to try a little soliloquy? Have a flair for the dramatic. I'll do my best with my voice here, unless anyone wants to volunteer. Any hams? Hams who do Hamlet? See, I think Nietzsche would say that, Aristotle would say that you look at people who are kind of reticent, they worry about what people think, and that you don't have people that are boisterous and loud, and that's part of this idea of low self-esteem. And this has to do with this idea that you're supposed to be humble and you're supposed to respect the rights of others, and the most important thing is that you don't hurt anybody, you gotta be sustainable, and you gotta recycle. And both Nietzsche, I think, is a little more about this idea that what you should try to do is make yourself as small as possible and make sure you don't hurt anybody. And Nietzsche would say that life itself is life, the nature of life is exploitation, and that in order to live, other things must die, and that that you should revel in the joy of life and not worry too much about whose toes you're stepping on. So here's this bit about the death of God. This is on page 170. This is from Joyful Wisdom. Given the unfortunate title, The Gay Science, when gay meant something different. Which, you know, in 1974, I think that would be still, I think Kaufman didn't realize that it would be kind of a faux pas, but Joyful Wisdom is probably a better translation. The Parable of the Madman. Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace, and cried incessantly, "I see God! I see God!" As many of those there who did not believe God in God were standing around just then, he provoked much laughter. "Has he got lost?" asked one. "Did he lose his way like a child?" asked another. "Or is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a long voyage, emigrated?" Thus they yelled and laughed. The madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his eyes. "Whither is God?" he cried. "I will tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are our murderers. But how did we do this? How can we drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there still any up and down? Are we not straying as though through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breadth of empty space? Has not it become colder? Is not night continually closing in on us? Do we not need light to light lanterns in the morning? Do we hear nothing as yet of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? Do we smell nothing as yet of the divine decomposition? God's too decomposed. God is dead. God remains dead. And we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers?" And then skip down here. Hear them. "There has never been a greater deed, and whoever is born after us, for the sake of the deed, he will belong to a higher history than all history hitherto." Here the madman fell silent and looked at again his listeners, and they too were silent and stared at him in astonishment. At last he threw his lantern on the ground and broke it to pieces, and it went out. "I have come too early," he said then. "My time is not yet. This tremendous event is still on the way, still wandering, has not yet reached the ears of men. Lightning and thunder require time. The light of the stars requires time. Deeds, though done, still require time to be seen and heard. This deed is still more distant than the most distant stars, and yet they have done it themselves. Okay, so what's Nietzsche's point of telling the story here? What do you think he's after? This is in... So he's writing this in the 19th century, mid-19th century, and then mid to late 19th century. Any idea of what's going on there?
Industrialization.
Yeah, industrial revolution, right?
And the prevailing attitude of science over religion in terms of like everyday society, like how society works.
Yeah.
How it's starting to get that way slowly.
Sure, what else? What about what's going on in science? Charles Darwin is writing about this time, and you get some people sort of putting forth the various theories of human origin. You get people becoming more and more secular. People are not going to church as much. You have people analyzing the text of the Bible and suggesting that they were that they're full of legend and mythology, that the first five books of the Bible weren't written by Moses, but that they were kind of cut and pasted together by different groups of scholars. And so there's a lot going on which is making society more and more secular. And Nietzsche's point is that you have Europeans who don't believe in the big man in the sky anymore. They don't believe in God. But they still say that their purpose in life is to love their neighbor as yourself. And they still have Christian charity, and they give money away to beggars in the street because it's their Christian duty. And if you ask people, they say they're a Christian, but then you ask them whether they think there's an afterlife, and they say it's a fantasy. If you ask if they believe in a God, and they'll say, well no. But yet they behave as if there is one. And so Nietzsche's What the parable of the madman, like at the end here, he says, "I've come too early." And the idea is that even though God is sort of on the way out, people don't realize it yet. So even though Christianity is on its way out, in Nietzsche's view, people are still behaving as if it were true, even though they don't really believe in it anymore. And so even though faith in God is dead, people don't realize it yet, and they're still living their lives according to Christian morality. They don't realize that this value system that they've been following all these years is based on a metaphysics they no longer accept. And so what they need, and Nietzsche, part of Nietzsche's polemic here is to try to get people to realize that Christian morality was only fitted for people who believed in this Christian worldview. Since nobody accepts the Christian worldview, now they accept the scientific worldview. We need a new set of morality, which goes along with the scientific worldview, including Charles Darwin and theory of evolution, natural selection. Thoughts so far? So, the need for new values. Again, you have this classical influence on Aristotle, of Aristotle. Also, Nietzsche has this idea of the will to power. The will to power is the principle of life which tries to grow, dominate, and prosper. So it's the will to power is the principle of life itself which seeks to grow, dominate, and prosper. And so Nietzsche says if you look at what a living thing does is it attempts to make itself as big as possible, it tries to reproduce, it tries to get control over its environment, and it tries to exploit its environment to make itself bigger and more powerful. I mentioned Nietzsche calls himself the world's greatest immoralist. And again, his idea that he wants to turn value on its head. And so, for example, he would say, well, you've heard that that you're supposed to be humble, that you should give God the glory, and that it's uncouth to brag about your accomplishments. Whereas Nietzsche would say that if you have some accomplishments and you're not bragging about them and taking credit for them, there's something wrong with you. And that humility is really a vice. And there's nothing worse than a person who won't take credit for his accomplishments and puts them on some fictitious being who supposedly made it possible. Nietzsche would say a person like that, they have some sort of psychological problem. They have low self-esteem. And this idea that it's a virtue to not take credit for accomplishments is a pathology. And he does this with a lot of different values, which we'll talk about in a minute here. And he thinks that conventional morality, this idea that you shouldn't enjoy sex too much, you shouldn't go out and have sex with a bunch of different partners, especially if you're a woman, because then you're a slut, right? Or how do you define slut? Well, someone who's having more sex than you are, I guess. But the idea is that sex is okay within the proper bounds of marriage, but it's only for procreation. And this is a common view, not just among Catholics, but also Protestants at the time, that sex is for procreation. You can enjoy it, but not too much. And if someone insults you, you're supposed to just take it and turn the other cheek. Nietzsche would say, if someone insults you, you should sock him in the jaw. If someone slaps you in the right cheek, punch him in the gut. and then after they go down, kick him a couple of times and make sure they don't get up again. That would be his view. This idea of this sort of mamby-pamby morality where you're always worried about other people and sticking your nose into their business and trying to help worthless derelicts and people living in the street and beggars and lepers and the sick and the weak, and extolling the virtues of the sick and the weak because they're going to be blessed in heaven in some future fictitious world to come, he says is a delusion. So Nietzsche isn't the sort of person that holds back. So in the genealogy of morals, he talks about two systems of morality. So you have masters and slaves. And you go back to the beginning of the civilization, there's two kinds of people. There's the rulers and the ruled. So once you have large-scale cities, you get a slave class. You get one group makes war on another group, the winner makes the losers slaves. And then pretty soon you have a hereditary slave class, and so who's out there in the field, picking the grain and doing all the grunt work, that's your slaves. And even if you don't have like literal slave class, you have people who are serfs or peasants, and then you have the nobility at the top. Yeah.
Isn't that kind of Marx, oppressed?
Yeah, except for Nietzsche says, the problem with Marx is he identified with the wrong group. Marx identified with the oppressed, whereas Nietzsche says you should identify with the oppressor. That's who you want to be. You want to be in the oppressor's shoes. Although oppression sounds like people have been suckered into this Christian morality which says that oppression is bad and that someday Jesus is going to come back and send all the oppressors to hell. And he says that's a bunch of nonsense. That really you want to be part of the ruling class. And you want to be, if not literally a master, you want to be a master of your own world. But anyway, he's just describing like how these two systems of morality came about. So the masters, the rulers, the nobility had one set of values, and the slaves, the rule, the peasants, or the literal slaves, had another system of morality. And these are two parallel systems of morality from people on the top to people on the bottom. The middle class is a very relatively new phenomenon. And so he says if you look back, what sorts of things made you a good master, those are going to be different than the sorts of things that made you a good slave. about that.
Doesn't Aristotle say the same kind of thing?
Aristotle, the thing about Aristotle is he doesn't talk much about slave morality. So he talks, Aristotle is pretty much all master morality. And he says, well, you gotta have some slaves to, you know, do the grunt work. And you can be the best darn slave you can be. But Aristotle does tend to think that the slaves will have similar sorts of virtues to the masters. I think he thinks that, like, if you do your job well and you act befitting your station, if you're a woman or a slave or a kind of a day laborer or something, that you can still have a life for what life's dealt you. You're not going to have as good a life as one of the nobility, but you can have a pretty good life. I think Aristotle thinks that you're pretty much going to have the same character traits are going to serve you there. Nietzsche says that's not so. So he says, for master morality, what are virtues? Strength, vitality. You have to wake up in the morning and say, who am I going to conquer today? If you're a ruler, you can't be sickly, you can't be, laying in bed. You got to go out there and, review the troops and give orders and go to banquets. You can't be there in your sick bed all the time. People are your enemies are going to think about assassinating you if you're sick. Ambition. You got to have ambition. You have to want to conquer. You're going to, you're going to want to have more land, more money, and more power. And that's what got you to be a master in the first place. Chairman Mao didn't get to be, the ruler of China by, going around helping people or sitting in his tent, in his navel. You gotta have ambition. Also, self-control is very important. You need to, this is one of the reasons why most people work for somebody else, because it requires a lot of self-discipline to work for yourself. It's not like there's a boss who, expects you to show up at 8 o'clock. You can wake up whenever you want. You can work whenever you want. And most people, they just don't work unless they have some external controlling force and some negative consequence. And so he thinks if you're a slave or if you're a peasant, you're getting orders from somebody else. And if you don't obey, you're going to be punished. If you're the master, you need to make sure you don't spend too much time drinking in a big banquet if there's a war brewing that you need to pay attention to. Or if there's a peasant revolution or something you have to deal with, you need to pay attention to your empire. Intelligence, maybe smart to rule. And also a certain sense of optimism. If you're all down in the dumps and depressed, you're not going to be a very good ruler, right? You need to project confidence and joy and optimism. And that's the sort of, those are the sort of qualities that people want to follow in the military sense, in a political leader sense too. Nobody likes, that's one of the reasons Richard Nixon wasn't that popular. I'm not a crook, that's not an inspiring speech. And he had a kind of dour look, even though, and he was actually kind of a moody person, but his image was sort of a dour image. They projected. Part of it was just sort of his facial features. He had kind of a hangdog look. Honesty. You need to face reality. If you're a leader, you need to be pragmatic. You need to be a bottom line kind of person. You can't be some sort of airy fairy idealist. You'll end up like Akhenaten, who was this kind of a religious fanatic pharaoh who ended up losing a bunch of wars and having his name chiseled off on a bunch of monuments, and everybody hated him because he was like the Jimmy Carter of Egypt. He's just like lousy economy, people were mired in malaise, right? You can't project that. And the way you avoid that is by being a realist, being honest with yourself and with other people. And if you're a powerful person, you don't have to lie, right? Who has to lie? The person who's worried about being punished if they tell the truth. Callousness. If you spend all your time worrying about the poor and the weak and sick, and spend all your time and resources helping people, you're not going to be out there conquering. You're not going to be, and you're not going to have to make the be able to make the tough decisions when if someone's disobeyed. You got to give them the 40 lashes. You can say, "Oh, I'll give them another chance," right? Because then people will realize you're a candy ass, and you're going to have a revolution in your hands. So those are all the traits of master morality. Now, slave morality is the exact opposite. So for slave morality, weakness is seen as a virtue. Why do you need to be strong as a slave? Well, I suppose you might get beaten if you can't do your task, but if you're weak and meek and even sickliness, it's seen as a virtue because you're suffering with your fellow slaves. And so the slaves will say, well, we're weak, you know, maybe singly, but and why are you a slave in the first place? You're probably a weak person. You would have gotten away, or you would have been conquered, or you would have found a way to sort of work your way up to the top. And this idea of being meek and humble, and I'm not sure why. I mean, he does talk about sickliness as being kind of a virtue. This makes sense in a religious context. I'm not sure in this is origin of morality, why exactly he says this. Complacency and acceptance, right? So, turn the other cheek makes sense because if you don't turn the other cheek, you're going to get 40 lashes, right? You know, if you're beaten by the taskmaster, you're the rational thing for you to do as a slave is get back to work. If you attack your taskmaster, you will be killed. And so, as a slave, your the virtue is to endure, to take it. Lack of discipline. You don't need any self-discipline because all your controls are external. You're told when you get up in the morning, when to go to bed, when to work harder. And so you don't really need discipline. And so you tend not to be disciplined yourself because you are used to being given orders. And slaves follow orders really good. But if you tell slaves, okay, I'm not going to give you orders anymore. I want you slaves to figure out how to do this most efficiently. They're not going to know what to do. And they're just going to slack until you come back with the whip and start beating them. What is that? I think there's a sign sometimes seen in government offices that the beatings will continue until morale improves. Stupidity. If you're too smart for your own good, you're likely to get a beating as a slave. Also, being gullible and having faith is good because that will help you endure your life. So if you think, I'm obeying my master as I would obey the Lord, and when I die, my soul will float up to be in heaven with God, and where I'll have my heart's desire, and I'll be unconditionally loved and accepted. And so I'm going to give the glory to God right now while I go clean these chamber pots or whatever. Right? So you're doing this, you have this lousy life where you're living a life of desperation, of hard labor and very little reward for it, no control over your life. And so this is what's going to get you through the day, is your faith. Pessimism, you know, if you get your hopes up, you're going to be disappointed, right? So no use getting your hopes up. So pessimism is seen as virtue in that if you expect the worst, you're liable to get it. If you get your hopes up, they're going to be dashed against the rocks. Self-delusion, denial of reality, and religion. When you have to deal with a really traumatic life, what's your best way to endure that without going out of your mind? Or maybe I shouldn't have said it without going out of your mind. The best solution is to go out of your mind. And so Nietzsche thinks that's what a religion is, essentially. You say, my life sucks, but there's a better world just around the corner. And in God's time, a thousand years of the day, the days of a thousand years. And so, and I've only got probably a couple of decades left, and I'll die and we'll go up to be with God in heaven, and everything will be sweetness and light. In the meantime, I'll go in here and, you know, dig in the mud some more, or whatever you have to do. So, whatever thankless task. Compassion and pity. When you're part of the slave class, you know, you got to kind of like support the guy next to you because he's going to support you. And so you got to hang together. You're kind of a collectivist. If you're a master, you're more of an individualist. And so the slaves, because each of them individually are weak, if one slave, in a moment of foolishness, insults the taskmaster and gets a really bad beating, the other slaves have pity on him and carry him back to the bunk and nurse him back to health. Why? Because maybe they might get beaten later on and they'll need someone to do the same for them. If you're a master, if you have control and power, you don't need to worry about other people taking care of you. People obey you because they fear you. So he says that what happens is the slaves resent their masters, and they have this conspiracy where they create this thing called morality to control the masters. And so the slave class created this thing called guilt, where the masters feel bad at punishing the slaves too badly. And so, and they feel bad at depriving them of food. And they feel good when they're generous towards their slaves. And so this, Nietzsche says, it's this sort of a illusion. It's a kind of a con that the slaves put on the masters to make their lives more bearable. The masters, on the other hand, the true masters won't be suckered in by this. But Nietzsche says that the masters hold the slaves in contempt, but they realize that they're necessary. So if you're a master, you don't want to empathize with the slave. But you got to be a realist too. You know you need the slaves. But it's not as if that gives the slaves power over you. It's just, Nietzsche makes this joke. He talks about masters as being like birds of prey. And he says, you know, sometimes a big bird of prey, like an eagle, can swoop down and pick up like a baby lamb and carry it off. And he says, you know, so you have like the birds of prey and the lambs. And he says, does the bird of prey hate the lamb? Well, why no? What they love the lambs. What's tastier than a little lamb? So they realize that the lambs are important, but they don't pity the lambs. They eat the lambs. For Nietzsche, the role model for master morality is the Viking. The Viking who says, Wotan is the North Nordic god of war. Wotan has put a cold heart in my breast. So the Vikings, what do? They exploit. They rob, loot, kill, pillage, and take what they need. And Nietzsche thinks metaphorically, this is the role you should aspire to. The slave role, Jesus is the master, is the role model there. What did Jesus do? He went around trying to help people and got himself killed for it and died a torturous death. And Nietzsche says you're living in bizarro world when you're supposed to empathize with a convicted criminal who died a death on an instrument of torture, and you're supposed to look at the Viking as being evil. You want to be like the Viking. You want to exploit the world for your good. And you want to be a master of your own world. You don't want to be a victim. And I suppose you think about today this idea of the victim mentality. Nietzsche, I think, would like that phrase. And he'd say, he actually coined this term herd mentality. And so the herd mentality is when you're a bunch of sheep and you're being led off to the slaughter, and you say, oh, I guess that's what we're supposed to do. We should go off and get slaughtered. That's God's will. And Nietzsche says you need to be more, you need to avoid the victim mentality, the herd mentality, and you should be more like the Viking. So the symbol of the master morality is this person Nietzsche calls the overman. And Nietzsche talks about in the future there'll be a form of man who is so much more advanced than us that we will look like apes by comparison. So look at how much more advanced we are than the apes. In the future there will be the overman. The overman will be more advanced, so much more advanced than us that we will appear as apes by comparison. And he thinks this is going to be a future, more evolved form of man who will live according to the world rules of master morality. Who won't be tied down by Christian morality. And he thinks part of this is going to be social change, but part of it's going to be physical evolution. And the overman, in part, is going to be bred as well as produced in a social way. Examples of masters, it's easy to think about Nietzsche as being kind of a threat to thug morality. And he did think that military leaders and political leaders are seen as examples of masters. But also great scientists. Nietzsche thought science, as a means of controlling the forces of nature is a part of his view. And so great scientists were seen as examples of masters. And also great artists. He was a great admirer of Wagner until they had a falling out. But he thinks that the way the artist creates and expresses is an expression of the will to power. So the artist expresses, the scientist finds out, and the military and political leaders, they rule and conquer. And those are the things which make for a great life. Going around helping people and turning the other cheek when someone spits in your face, and expecting Jesus to come any day now, that's no way to live. That song, one last thing is the will to power. Then we'll talk a little bit more about the will to power next time, again. This life principle that's tried to grow, dominate, and prosper. So between now and next time, think about what you think about, think about Nietzsche's view of morality and whether you agree or not. And we'll have a freewheeling discussion about it on Wednesday. See you then.